Welcome to episode 144 of the Sentientism podcast, a podcast about what's real and what matters. The Sentientism worldview answers those two deep questions by committing to evidence, reason, and having compassion for all sentient beings. In this episode, I speak with Dr. Katie Mack. Katie is a theoretical cosmologist who holds the Hawking Chair in Cosmology and Science Communication at Perimeter Institute. Her academic research investigates dark matter, vacuum decay, and the epoch of reionization. Katie is also a popular science communicator on social media, mostly as Astro Katie, through public speaking and by writing regularly for Scientific American, Slate, Sky and Telescope, Time and Cosmos. She's the author of the book, The End of Everything, Astrophysically Speaking. I'd love to know what you think of this episode and 143 others. Don't forget to work through our back catalogue if you just found us. Every person who reviews and rates or shares our podcast with a friend helps us nudge more people towards more compassionate, rational thinking. You can find out more about Sentientism at sentientism.info, or you can sign up for email updates, or just search for Sentientism on your favourite social media platform. You'll be made very welcome in all of our global online communities. They're open to anyone interested, not just sentientists. Thanks for listening. Good morning, Dr. Mack. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Yeah, very good. You're starting your day with coffee, and I'm probably drinking coffee after I should still be drinking it.
I am starting my day with green tea, as I always do. So
yeah, you're putting me to shame that even there. So, yeah. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to join this series of Sentientist Conversations. You're definitely the first guest we've had who's a cosmologist. You're definitely the first guest who's had the honor of being heckled by Stephen Hawking. And you're we like to pride ourselves on asking big questions here, but as a cosmologist, you are potentially even bigger questions than the one we ask here. So it's great to have the chance to talk to you. And as you know, because it's brilliant that you've had a chance to listen to a few of these episodes already. So it's an honor to have you as a guest already. I know you listened to the one with Adrian Tchaikovsky, for example. But it's a series of conversations about what I think of as the most important and deepest philosophical questions about what's real, how do we understand the universe, how to believe and what to believe, but just as importantly, the big questions of ethics, what matters and who matters. And I have an obvious bias because I'm trying to popularize and develop this really simple pluralistic worldview called sentientism, which I summarize as evidence, reason, and compassion for all sentient beings. So it takes a naturalistic approach to that what's real question. And it takes a sentiocentric approach to the ethical question. It says that every sentient being, any being that can suffer or flourish or experience things, warrants our compassion and our moral consideration. But I talk to people in these conversations, as you know, both who, you know, agree with that way of thinking and vehemently disagree. So it'll be fascinating to understand your own personal story and how your work fits into that. But before we get to those big questions, how would you best introduce yourself and your work to those rare people in my audience who don't know you?
I'm an astrophysicist. I study cosmology, which is the study of the universe from beginning to end, from the smallest to the largest scales. So really trying to understand how the universe works, how it's evolved over time, what really makes it all tick. So that's my research. I'm mostly focused these days on dark matter, which is some mysterious invisible stuff that holds galaxies together. That's most of the matter in the universe. And I'm also interested in the very early universe and the end of the universe. So I have a book that I wrote about the end of the universe called The End of Everything. And that's something that I find really fascinating, that question of like, where is it all going and what does that mean? So yeah, so my work is mainly in those areas. And I also have a position at the Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics in Canada, where I am sort of split between research and public engagement. So my job title is the Hawking Chair in Cosmology and Science Communication. And that's to reflect the fact that I really do both of those things.
Yeah, it's a fascinating balance, yeah. And it'll be interesting when we come back to talking about how can we make a better future, how you see the role of science, but also science communication in trying to make a better world too. Yeah, that's great. And it's interesting as we come on to this first big question about what's real, because your work clearly is very much in the scientific world, but many people who work in science, it doesn't necessarily mean they have a completely scientific worldview more broadly. So it's going to be interesting to explore that with you. So, and as we answer this question about what's real, for many of my guests, it's a story about whether they grew up originally in a family in a society that was maybe more supernatural or religious or mystical in some sense, mm-hmm. or one that was quite naturalistic, maybe scientifically minded, maybe atheistic, agnostic, and how mm-hmm. that side of their thinking has changed over time. So you can wind the clock back as far into your childhood as you feel comfortable, but it'll be fascinating to know your story on, you know, your epistemology, if you like, and where you are now on that journey.
So I grew up, you know, going to church with my family when I was a kid. We were part of our church was United Church of Christ, which is a very sort of liberal, open-minded kind of non-fundamentalist Protestant denomination that, you know, is about the meaning of the gospel, but not the literal, you know, interpretation of the gospel. And it was an interesting space because it was also a church that was very progressive, very into social justice, sending groups to the Pride Parade, that kind of thing, a large LGBT portion of the congregation. So that was kind of the environment I grew up in. And it wasn't the kind of place where, you know, you were asked a lot about what you believed in per se. I found it useful to go to, you know, to church. I was part of the youth group, it was useful to spend some time thinking about like how to be a good person and like how to be nice to people and like, you know, here are some guidelines for life. I always thought that was very useful, but I never really understood how faith works per se, I guess. Mm-hmm. The idea of believing in things without evidence. I think I also grew up with a very scientific viewpoint in that area, and over time, you know, I explored a lot of different kind of religious traditions. I ended up for complicated reasons very involved in like Judaism, and ended up for a while attending church on Sunday mornings and synagogue on Friday nights, was kind of, you know, really, really interested in that practice, and I found that all very meaningful, but I never really understood the idea of belief. And it was something that I was always really fascinated by and really intrigued by, and I think I always wanted to believe something. You know, I think that there's a fundamental urge that most humans have to connect with the divine. I think that is just part of being a person. Most people, not everybody, but most people have a need to connect with something bigger than themselves, something more meaningful, something wiser and powerful, right?
Yeah. So you felt that pull.
I think for most people that manifests as spirituality of some kind. And I definitely had that impulse, like I wanted that connection with the divine, but the problem was I didn't believe in anything, and this is something that just continued throughout my life. That I would go to these services and I would really connect with the philosophy, with the songs, with the, you know, the prayer, the ritual, you know, especially rituals around like forgiveness and bettering yourself and all of that. You know, I found the high holidays practices in Judaism extremely useful. This idea of, you know, once a year you make right with everybody. That's a good thing to do. There were a lot of things that I found very meaningful and very useful. But, you know, I would go to these like Bible study groups or whatever at school or you know with at college, and I would go because I was really interested in the Bible. but then they would say things like, you know, you have to submit your mind to God, And they would talk about having faith and how, you know, you shouldn't look for proof and you shouldn't look for evidence and you should just believe and just believe. And I was like, I don't know how you do that. Like, I don't know how to tell my brain to believe something that it does not believe. You know, like, I believe things if I see evidence for them, if I have some, you know, reason, but I don't know how to decide to change the perception of my brain. I don't know how that works. And I still don't understand.
That was something that was just sort of quite hard coded into the way your mind worked. Is you just, this just does not compute. How could you come to believe something without having some grounding for it? Yeah.
I mean, part of that is just that I was a sort of scientifically curious kid, I guess, it's not how I perceive my mind working, I guess.
Yeah.
It's not that I think that I'm more rational than other people, or I don't think it's like that. I think it's just, it's the way I relate to the world, the way I relate to what I perceive to be reality is through evidence one way or another. And that might not be good evidence. I'm certainly not the most reliable witness, but at least, like, I don't fundamentally grasp the concept of choosing your perceptions, choosing your beliefs. I don't think I can do that.
Yeah. And it's, I find it fascinating, but because there's almost this distinction between an ontological question of whether supernatural stuff exists as well as the natural world. And there's different approaches there. And I take a pretty strongly naturalistic approach there as well, although I try and keep some small potentiality of credence open to, you know, maybe some even crazy supernatural stuff exists. I don't want to lock that off completely dogmatically, but I'm pretty confident the natural world is all there is, really.
Yeah.
But then there's this other sense of a naturalistic way of thinking, which is, as you were saying, it's more the method, the approach we go about using to try and set our beliefs and our credences. And that's partly why I use the term evidence and reason in describing this sentientism idea, because I think actually the method is sort of more important than the conclusion. Mm. If you're committed to using evidence and reason in as good a way as you can, always imperfect, that's more important really than some sort of dogmatic statement about the natural or the supernatural. But I find it interesting because even there's a split, because I'm pretty naturalistic on both fronts, because my methodological naturalism, if you like, my use of evidence and reason has led me to be pretty confident that the natural world is all there is, almost by definition, because if we found some evidence of something supernatural, it seems to me to have become part of the natural world, because how else could we have got the evidence? So they collapse together for me, but for other people, they don't. So for other people with a religious or a supernatural worldview, some will absolutely say, it's faith, I don't need evidence. There's even some pride in taking that alternative path. But others will say, oh no, I'm with you on the evidence and reason stuff, Jamie. It's just that you haven't understood the Quran or the Bible or interpreted history. You know, the answers in Genesis, people spend a lot of time thinking through evidence and reason to justify.
Well, and there are people who have had spiritual experiences that they feel very strongly the only explanation is some supernatural thing, or there are people who interpret various aspects of the natural world to be sign of a intelligent designer in one way or another. I haven't had a spiritual experience. I don't know how I would interpret it if I did. I assume that I would write it off as something that's explainable through, you know, psychology and physics, but I can't say for certain that I would do that, because I don't know, you know, what that would consist of. But yeah. I mentioned that, you know, I wanted to learn more about religion, and I had this kind of, I was drawn to religion, but it was actually even more than that. After I graduated undergrad, I spent I enrolled in a theology school for a year. It was partly that kind of wanting to understand, you know, wanting to connect with something bigger, but it was mostly, I think, just wanting to understand religion as a concept or as a sociological activity. I wanted to understand why people believe in things and what they believe in. And I went through physics undergrad at Caltech, and I decided that I really wanted to take a year to do something else before jumping into grad school in astrophysics, because I thought that I would burn out entirely if I did that. And I wanted to take some time to study something else. So I actually spent, I enrolled in a year-long certificate program at the Pacific School of Religion, which is it's a United Church of Christ seminary in Berkeley. I dropped out after 6 months, so I didn't complete the course. But I did learn a lot about religion when I was there. The reason that I had dropped out, I think, though, is that it was kind of a combination of things. It was one of the things was that I just missed doing astrophysics and I wanted to get back to that. And I had deferred a year for grad school at Princeton, and so I kind of wanted to get into that. But part of it, though, was that I was surrounded by people who were, you know, seminary students who were planning to go into the ministry, and they all had faith, and I couldn't relate to it. Even, you know, and even being this, you know, very non-fundamentalist place where, you know, people like the idea of what you believe in is not the most important thing. It was more about the kind of practice and more about the scripture and the lessons. Even at a place like that, everybody had faith. Everybody had had some experience of God in some way, or they had some assurance that this was the correct worldview. And I just found it so frustrating, you know, and I felt like, you know, I've done everything right. Like I went to every service I could come up with.
Yeah.
You
invested.
I invested. I went to seminary. Like I did all the things, and I still, God is not to me in any way. And it was a little bit frustrating because I was a little bit jealous that these were people who had that certainty, you know, that everybody around me had that certainty, that feeling of peace that comes with having, you know, knowing that you are loved by the most powerful being in the cosmos, right? Like, that sounds pretty cool. The idea that you're, you know, you're going to die, but it's going to be okay because you're going to be happy forever. Like, awesome. Like, sign me up. I want that.
Yeah, as long as you follow the rules.
Well, yeah, or, you know, not necessarily. Like, there's, you know, all this saved by grace kind of stuff. This idea that you don't have to follow the rules, you just have to believe, and that's the one thing I can't do. Yeah. The thing is, I did follow the rules. Like, I knew I knew all the rules. I could follow all of the rules. Like, that was a very simple thing. I couldn't believe. That's the problem, right? Yeah. Like, I couldn't make myself have the faith, right? So if the idea is that you're only saved through belief and not through actions, there's no hope for me at all.
Yeah, there's no redemption path. Yeah.
No.
Did the people in the seminary class, because it's sort of, how open were you? Did they raise that with you? Were they worried you were going to hell, or is it?
Oh, no. It wasn't that kind of place. No, it wasn't that kind of place at all. Like, everybody was very, you know, very chill about it. Nobody was trying to force any beliefs on anybody. I mean, it was essentially, you know, it was understood that, you know, your beliefs are your own thing, but, you know, we're going to talk about the scripture. We're going to talk about, you know, the principles of theology. We're going to talk about sociology of religion. Like, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't like, it wasn't the kind of place where anybody hassled anybody about what they believed in. Everybody was assumed to be on their own spiritual journey. I just didn't have one.
Yeah. It just happened that everybody else was sort of already there and you were a fish out of water.
Somewhere. Yeah. And there was a real range of beliefs, of different kinds of beliefs, different backgrounds, you know, people who'd grown up Mennonite, people who'd been Unitarian, Universalist, like there's a range of things. And in my classes, you know, there were the Franciscan brothers, and there were the, and I was, I took there. So that seminary was part of a group of seminaries with other denominations. So there were people from all sorts of different areas of sort of Christian faith and in that group. And so, you know, ended up in classes with people from across the spectrum. So, you know, that was not a problem. Nobody cared that I didn't believe in anything. But I just felt a little out of place. I felt a little left out in a way that was a little bit hard to articulate, I guess. I mean, you know, it was funny because like they all knew I was an astrophysicist, so they, you know, they would call me Astrophysicist Katie, and they would say things like, like, oh, you know, I find astrophysics so spiritual. And I was like, I don't, you know, I really don't. Like, this is an entirely separate part of my life. Yeah. I didn't come to a seminary to figure out how God is at work in the cosmos. I did it because I wanted to learn about, you know, why people believe stuff. But it was a very strange experience. And it's something I almost never talk about. Like most people, most of my friends, most of my colleagues have no idea that I ever studied religion, that I ever had any kind of religious background. Those people who know anything about my past, you know, are probably very confused about, you know, which religion I was part of, because I was kind of doing a lot of things in a lot of areas. But it was an interesting thing. I mean, I learned a lot. I took some really interesting classes. I met some really great people. But I think that fundamental frustration of how come this is working for them and it's not working for me was kind of there the whole time.
Yeah, well, you gave it a good go. And it's fascinating because the conversations I've had, some of my guests still maintain a sort of classical religious affiliation, if you like, but most have left and some have moved away from a traditional religion and gone down a, you know, spiritual but not religious path. Some maintain an affiliation with a religious community but have no supernatural beliefs whatsoever, because like you, I think they felt that affinity with the community and they felt that some of the ethics, you know, was already quite progressive and social justice focused and that worked. You know, the supernatural stuff just doesn't work. And other people have followed a sort of classical, right, I'm now an atheist, I'm a naturalistic mindset through and through.
I mean, I totally miss the community stuff. Occasionally, I think I should start going back to synagogue or something, like just to, because I miss that. There's a lot about it that I miss. I miss the practice. I miss the ritual. I miss the mindset, the there's a scholarliness in studying the scripture and trying to understand the ethical point of views. I find that really exciting, like just it feeds something, and just the idea that everybody gets together once a week to spend an hour thinking about how to be better people, like I think that's great.
What's not to like about that? And I think that there is a risk sometimes of sort of throwing the baby out with the bathwater, where people move away from a you know, religious community and way of thinking and then do feel a genuine gap there. And I think it's possible to find all of those things in a secular, naturalistic way of operating, but it's often not quite as easy because it's not packaged and there isn't a history, there isn't a tradition, there aren't necessarily local groups. And I think that's part of the reason why, as I understand it, in many religious communities, within those communities, you'll find a lot of people who technically aren't religious at all. And I mean, it seems to be particularly you know, quite prevalent in Judaism, where there's a lot of people who are reasonably comfortable saying, you know, I don't actually believe in God. It's similar in the sort of Anglican church here as well, where even people who are leaders in the church will say, of course, it's just a parable, really. It's just a story, you know.
And
what they're really trying to do is bring communities together and to find ways of being better people. But it links to the different paths away from a religious world, because it sounds like you would describe yourself as, you know, non-religious now. I don't know if you use terms like atheist or agnostic or how you describe yourself, but
I haven't tried to define it in a while. For a while I would kind of consider myself to be, you know, practicing but non-believing, I guess, in the sense, or, you know, religious but not spiritual, and if you want to think about it that way, perhaps. I mean, at the moment I don't know, for I guess agnostic. The problem with the term agnostic for me is that I think that the technical definition is the idea that you cannot know, and I don't think that, I think that that's stating too much. I think that it's possible that maybe there is a way to know, but I don't. So my official position is I don't know.
I like it and I'm with you. I'm, you know, I'm quite open to the idea that there might be limits to human knowledge. I mean, we're sort of evolved apes. Why should we have some privileged, perfect ability to understand everything? But I don't want to draw those lines or shut those doors. You know, the way to find out if there are limits is just to keep pushing and keep trying. So the other thing that's interesting is that with some of my guests, the thing that's pushed them away from established religion has actually been more the ethical questions. And it tends to be something that plays through some of the more fundamentalist flavors of religion, whatever that might be. So it was actually an ethical thing that originally made them think, hold on, there's something wrong here. And it might have been homophobia or sexism, or it might have been something about, hold on, this idea of a hell where innocent people will be sent doesn't seem to be consistent with a compassionate God. And so that was the trigger. And then they start to think about the supernatural stuff. Whereas to you, it sounds like for you, it was more about the evidence and reason and the fact stuff, partly because the ethics actually felt quite comfortable in the denominations.
I was very fortunate to be in religious communities where, you know, they were very progressive. They were very focused on social justice. They were very open and affirming of you know, LGBT people. So I never felt concerned about the ethical stuff there when when I sort of came to terms with being bisexual myself. I didn't feel like I was shut out of my religious communities. I felt like that was totally with how those, you know, the sort of welcoming aspects of those communities. And I felt like the communities I was in were, you know, doing positive things in toward equality. So, you know, that part was never, fortunately, I was not in a position where that could have been a problem. I know that a lot of people, in the queer community, have horrible experiences with the church and with their religious communities in various ways. And I was very, very lucky not to have that. I always understood that you know, I would be accepted. So that wasn't an issue. And, you know, like politically and ethically and morally, like, those things all were fine. It was just the faith. just the believing in stuff that was a problem.
It's pretty clean, and it's good to hear, and it's sort of encouraging as well, because that's one of the things that can be difficult with both traditional and religious communities, is that sometimes change doesn't come that easily. So it's really encouraging when you can find communities that can sort of focus on the essential good stuff, you know, the golden rule or the platinum rule, and the, you know, and caring about the world and caring about each other and focus on that, and selectively jettison the more problematic stuff. So that's encouraging.
Yeah.
Now, one of the things before we come off this sort of what matters question, because I think you and I probably shared a sort of broadly naturalistic approach, you know, we want to use evidence and reasoning, acknowledging their flaws to try and imperfectly try and, you know, understand the world, you know, let's engage with reality honestly to try and understand it. Which I don't really see a better alternative, but others disagree. But one of the things I find fascinating is that there are areas of human knowledge where the temptation to bring the supernatural back into play tends to creep back in. So often those are either origins, the origins of the universe, or the origins of life, or the origins of humans, or the origins of consciousness. And they can also be the ends of these things as well, you know, so questions of death or questions of the end of the universe, you know, hence some of your work, where people can look at those things and find there's understandable scientific uncertainty. So then there's a desperation to inject into that all of these sort of mystical, the God of the gaps and the human stuff, and putting themselves at the center of the story as well.
Yeah.
But I should turn it into a question, really. But that links to this challenge that in physics, particularly some of the areas of physics, it's looking quite bright there. I think the Lord is shining upon you.
No, I was just noticing I've got this like this iridescent, beautiful kind of thing going on. Hold on a second. I'm just going to move. I don't have the kind of blinds that can really block out the sun, but I have a large overcoat that I can hang up on
That's perfect. I thought it was a message from above being sent to.
I know, right?
Like, that could have been your spiritual experience. We could have recorded
it. That was the God of the gap specifically in my curtains.
But I guess my let me try and turn this into a question. I should really work out how to do interviews by now. But physics is weird, right? There is some deeply weird stuff in your work.
Yeah.
And whether it's at the quantum end or whether it's the cosmological end, there's just stuff that, one, we don't understand, and the things we do understand are massively counterintuitive. So those things are weird. How do we keep open-minded about the possibility that weird stuff is true without letting that become a door where people can sort of inject mysticism and woo and fabrications in? Do you think there is a way of doing both?
I mean, I think that, I think that weirdness is kind of, is in the eye of the beholder, right? Like what we're trying to do in physics, fundamentally, what we're trying to do in physics is to create a mathematical model of the universe that best matches what we observe in reality, right? And there are different ways to think about that. You can think about that as being like, we are trying to understand the fundamental nature of reality, you know, and that's a perfectly reasonable way to think about it. The way I think about it is more that we are attempting to create a model that is useful, that describes what we observe in our observations. And useful here means, you know, we can use that model to describe other observations. We can predict the outcomes of other experiments. It's a consistent model where if we calculate something in the model and then we do an experiment, we know what the experiment is going to tell us. It's going to be the same way every time. We can do a range of different things, and it fits together in this way. So I think that, you know, physics is about trying to create those models, trying to match our observations to our mathematical theories. So when something is weird, like, it may or may not be that it doesn't match the model, right? Like, quantum mechanics seems really weird in a lot of ways, but mathematically it's extremely clear and simple, right? Like, we can write down the wave functions, we can write down the equations that govern the evolution of these wave functions, and when we do experiments, it matches perfectly, right? Like, everything is exactly as the model would predict. The model is an extremely useful model that is not in any way in conflict with the results of the experiments. We think of it as weird because, you know, the model that applies on the subatomic world is different from the model that applies on the macroscopic world in terms of, like, you know, if you roll a ball across a table, you can write down equations for where that ball will go, and it all makes sense, and it's all sort of deterministic to some large degree. And there, you know, the ball doesn't split into two and interfere with itself and then come back together. And whereas on the subatomic level, stuff like that does happen, but it happens in a way that's entirely consistent with the equations that apply on those at that level. And so, you know, we think of it as weird just because it's unusual, it's, you know, unfamiliar, but it doesn't mean that there needs to be, like, as long as we have a model, you don't even have a gap to put God into, right? Like, it doesn't, that's not even there. Yeah. Now, there are aspects of subatomic theory that we don't understand yet. And one of the things that people talk about a lot, and when I was in seminary, there was, I attended a lecture by somebody who was trying to connect physics, is trying to connect God to quantum mechanics, and that person was saying essentially that, you know, when the wave function collapses, like, you know, when you have a quantum event that can go one of two different directions and you can't predict which one, it's a probabilistic thing, that they were saying that it's God who decides which of those things is going to be, right? Yeah. Because we don't have a model to say how a wave function will collapse. We don't have a model just to say, like, you know, it does seem to be a probabilistic thing. There's no deterministic process that we know of that creates that. And so that's where a lot of these interpretations of quantum mechanics comes in, like the many worlds hypothesis, where every time a quantum mechanics event happens, the world splits in two, and in one universe it goes one way, and the other universe it goes the other way. There are other interpretations that go, you know, that have different ways of explaining that. And this person who gave this lecture said, oh, it's God who makes that decision. And you know, I mean, you can do that. I don't think it's useful. I think it's, so I guess from my perspective, like, the God of the gap stuff is just not a useful approach. And because I think of physics as being about creating models that are useful, there's nothing useful about saying that a supernatural power is making a decision. And you can't use that to predict future experiments. You can't use that to refine your understanding of a physical process. And so it's kind of outside the realm of stuff that I'm interested in, I guess. Yeah. I would say that it's outside of what physics is about, what physics is for. And so I don't really have a way to kind of comment on it because it's separate from what I do. What I do is I try to find these useful models, and that is not a useful model. I mean, I think there's some famous quote about, you know, I have no need of that hypothesis. Some yeah. physicist said about, you know, the supernatural in regard to some experiments. But in my case, it's just, it's just not a useful direction to go.
Yeah. But even there, I guess there's a couple of directions people can take. One is, and I suspect yours is this path where you say, look, it's not relevant, it's not useful, it doesn't really add anything. In a way, it's somewhat arbitrary, right? You could say, you know, human consciousness is that thing, or, you know, you can make anything up, right?
Where's the devil or whatever?
Like, yeah, whereas others will take part of what you said and say, well, you know, that's outside of the domain that I work on in physics, but maybe there's some validity to it. So, and there are, you know, there are physicists and scientists who still maintain a religious belief through that sort of compartmentalization.
It's not for me to say if that is useful to you in some way. If saying this is something I don't understand, I'm gonna interpret that as God, like that's then part of a private practice, right? That's part of a personal worldview that I have no say in. It's not up to me to tell people how to think about the world. So, what is up to me is to try to make better models of the workings of the universe through physics and mathematics. And when I do that, those kinds of insertions of spirituality are just a distraction, and it's outside of the realm of what I'm doing.
Yeah, makes sense. Thank you. Really clear. So let's move on from this. First big question of what's real, although we may come back to it again, and move on to the questions of ethics. And many people who've adopted a very sort of naturalistic, maybe scientific worldview, for some people that leads them into a sort of almost nihilistic sense of ethics, where they're like, well, ultimately we're all just quarks and Schrodinger's equation or whatever it is, or, you know, dimensions in the Hilbert space churning away. The universe is just a series of physical processes with a start, maybe with an end. That's it. In that sense, really, in that cosmic sense, really nothing matters. Mm-hmm. Others will keep hold of, adopt that sort of scientific naturalistic worldview, but maintain some of the ethics they've picked up from a supernatural worldview or a package. And others still will, you know, build their own sort of naturalistically grounded ethics. And others will see them as completely distinct areas, if you like, where, you know, there's the classic is-ought boundary. So how have you come to think about, I guess, what matters, good, bad, right, and wrong? Again, from early days into where how would you answer that question now?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't think I ever saw it as being a question of what God wants me to do. Like, I don't think that's ever been part of my thinking.
That was really interesting the way you told the story earlier on, because for some people, the religious stuff comes as a package. So if their belief starts to falter, then they're really worried the ethics will crumble. But you never felt that dependency. Right. It was just like, I like this ethic.
No. Yeah. I mean, and I think I always understood that things like, commandments or rules in religion were based on, you know, just not being bad. Like not being terrible to other people, not doing things that are awful. And there were parts of it, you know, like there's in Christianity, at some point in the gospel, there's this statement that the most important commandment is to love God, you know, and it's like, well, I don't know what that means, but I can not kill people. Not lie. I can choose not to steal, and I can be an honorable person. I think I always had a feeling of, I've always felt it's very important to be an honorable person. And I don't know where I got that exactly, but this idea that lying is dishonorable, or that cheating is dishonorable, that's something that's always been really core to how I think about the world. And I'm not really sure where I got that, but it was this idea of honor rather than rather than, you know, sort of some kind of spiritual ethical viewpoint. But I also have always been somebody who's felt very keenly the suffering of others and not wanted to be part of that. And I'm sure we'll get into more of that later on when we talk about you know, animals. But you know, I've always felt very strongly about not wanting to harm animals, not wanting to harm other people, not wanting to, like, not being comfortable with witnessing harm to anybody. You know, I've always hated violence in films and movies. I can't, you know, I can't view other people suffering. Yeah. In general, I can't watch nature shows because somebody always eats a baby animal. Like, I can't yeah. deal with yeah. that. So, yeah. So I think that a lot of the way that I approach the world is probably just, you know, I'm just soft-hearted in some sense. But the idea of whether or not a scientific worldview kills the possibility of ethical principles is interesting in that. So there's something that I've had to talk about a lot since writing this book about the end of the universe. So because one of the things that you come up against very, very quickly when you're thinking about the end of the universe is that there will be a point in the future when nothing that we've ever done will have mattered, right? Because inevitably you get to a point where everything is destroyed, all evidence of the existence of humanity or any organized structure is destroyed, right? Like, it's all gone. Yeah. And so there's a point where we just have no legacy. And this is really, you know, this is really challenging if you are attached to the idea of carry on. So for example, you know, when people, when you tell someone, like, well, you're going to die, right? Like, everybody's going to die, right? We understand that we're going to die. A lot of people sort of become comfortable with that through the idea that, well, you know, I'm going to die, but my legacy will live on, you know, my children will carry on, or, you know, the impact I've had on my community, or, you know, this amazing book that I wrote, like, people will read that, or just even in a much smaller way, like, I did something that indirectly had some effect on the world around me, that indirectly will have some imprint on the future, right?
Your, like, tweets will still be out there.
Sure. Or just the fact that, like, you know, that, you know, I helped someone up who fell down, like, then that person's going to go on to cure cancer, whatever. Like, there's going to be some aspect of my life that will have mattered in the future. And people find that very comforting, right? Like, that's something that makes people more okay with the idea that they're going to die, is that they have some legacy. And if the universe is going to end, if it's going to fully end, then at some point that argument no longer applies, right? Yeah. There will be a point where it will not have mattered if I kill someone tomorrow or not, right? Yeah. Like, it doesn't matter. And
those ripples may go out for a long way, but ultimately they will end, right? And there'll be
black holes
fizzling out quietly.
And those black holes evaporating at the end of the universe are not going to care if I led a good life, if I hurt people, if there was suffering. Like, it doesn't matter, right? Like, it doesn't matter to physics. And so then you have to ask the question, like, how do you find meaning in a universe that's doomed, right? Like, if your idea of meaning hinges on the outcome, on the final reckoning, if there is no outcome, then how do you interpolate backward from that to figure out what you should do?
No cosmic scoreboard.
And you know, if you have a religious viewpoint, sure, you can find some, you can talk about the rapture, you can talk about, you know, the judgment day or whatever, you can figure ways to do that. But if you are just looking at the universe in a physical way, you don't have that. And for me, I feel like it was, when I was thinking about this, writing the book, I felt like it was a way of kind of reinforcing the idea that as humans living in a temporary world, in a temporary universe, we have to find structures of meaning that apply in the now, that apply in the present, that don't rely on the future at all. that are not outcome-based, because we can't rely on the future. And so there has to be ways of assigning meaning to the world as we live in it, to assigning a purpose to the world now, that acknowledges the fact that we are all temporary, that we're all gonna cease to exist. And so that's kind of a bigger philosophical question, I guess, about meaning, about purpose. But in terms of like ethics, I guess my ethical viewpoint is a little bit similar. Thinking about morality is that I'm not waiting for some judgment on whether or not what I've done is correct. It's more about am I harming now?
Yeah.
Am I making things better or worse for those around me? Am I, you know, helping things, you know, evolve toward a better world or not in the moment? You know, I mean, I think that's kind of how I build my thinking around morality and ethics.
Yeah, thank you. No, that's a fascinating journey. And there is this approach more based around this divine command theory that you hinted at earlier on, where the ultimate commandment is, you know, love God, and in other contexts, submit to God. And in those contexts, often even the common sense compassion we feel for each other is ultimately because God commanded us to be compassionate rather than because we
love your neighbor. To each,
yeah, love thy neighbor, but ultimately only because God says, not necessarily because you directly just care about your neighbor. And you clearly were very comfortable disconnecting that and just focusing on the sort of common sense stuff. But it was interesting how you talked about a combination of a sense of, you know, maybe honor and obligation and wanting to follow rules and, you know, do the right thing, which is a sort of deontological way of thinking. Mm-hmm. But you then complemented that with, you know, this focus on suffering and caring about the experiences of others and so on. I very much share that sort of sense that, in a cosmic sense, nothing ever matters. But thinking you need a cosmic scoreboard at the end of the universe, to my mind, is just a hangover of a religious worldview. And it's interesting how many people with a very naturalistic worldview have still got quite a lot of stuff going on in their heads that came from a religious upbringing that makes you think that way. Whereas I do think you can recenter it on, ultimately for me, all value is in every moment of sentient experience. And, you know, what impact can we have on the suffering, the flourishing of others? That's meaning enough for me. But
it is interesting that that question of like, you know, what's the point of everything if it's all going to end? That doesn't just come from religious people. Like, that comes from everybody. The idea that you know, existence must be meaningless if it's not going to go on forever. You know, I think that I see how that comes out of religiosity, but I think that a lot of people apply it beyond that in ways that are a little bit more complex.
Absolutely. And so, and it's clear that this idea of caring about the suffering of others is central for you. And you talked about that being, if you like, quite an emotional thing, a sentimental thing, a sense of empathy. Yeah. Others come to it from, you know, sort of more of a clinical, rational, you know, philosophical sense as well. And in a sense, I don't really mind where you get to it. Ultimately, as long as we feel that compassion for others, that's the center of a naturalistic ethic for me. But there's the second part of this ethical question is who matters? Because I think many people, religious and not, would agree with you and me that the suffering of others matters, that we should feel compassion for each other, we should try not to harm, we should try and help. But they might only think of a certain subgroup of humans as they work that ethics through. They might, if they're more expansive, think of all humans, you know, all universal human rights, for example, at least aspire to caring about all humans. But there's clearly levels beyond that. And you hinted at, you know, you mentioned non-human animals too. So what journey have you gone through thinking about this question of moral scope? You know, who gets to matter in that ethical system of yours? Whose suffering matters? And how's that picture changed over time? And where are you now?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I think that for me, it ultimately arises through through that kind of emotional, empathetic aspect. So I became a vegetarian when I was 7 years old,
Wow.
Seven was around the time when I started to understand where meat comes from and how that works. I knew when I was younger than that, you know, animals are killed for meat. Like I knew that, but I think I didn't really internalize what that meant until I was 7 years old, until I was kind of starting to understand like how that industry works, like
turning point, or was it just a
there was a moment, like there's a story that, you know, I was out to dinner with my family and we were at some restaurant and I was eating a hot dog and there was a kid's menu and the kid's menu had like little pictures of cartoon pigs on it, and I was like, oh, that's a pig, that's a hot dog, like these are the my memory of it is making that connection in a deep way at that dinner table. I'm sure that it wasn't as simple as that. I know that we kind of construct these memories after the fact as a story, but that was my memory of it, that I just kind of, you know, just started really putting that together and really connecting. This is a creature, this is an animal, and I don't want to hurt that animal, and therefore I shouldn't be eating this food. So I think that as soon as I really got the connection between that's an animal with a life and with the ability to experience pain, and then I connected that to what I was consuming, I didn't want to be part of that anymore. I didn't want to be part of the system that caused harm to animals, and it was because I didn't want to hurt animals, because I liked animals. It has always affected me personally, emotionally, to see or to understand an animal experiencing pain. I mean, I've always been somebody who's loved animals, who's wanted to care for animals. So for me, it was just like the emotional aspect was very automatic and honestly very inconvenient, because I would constantly be experiencing the pain of suffering creatures, and there was always suffering creatures. Like that was something that's always happening around me.
I think many children of that age would share that immediate sense of empathy and compassion for the non-human mm-hmm. animals that we can see and that are around us, you know, companion animals, maybe animals we might experience in the wild. But we conveniently manage to, you know, switch that off when we can't see the animal, when they're detached from us, when the form of the product is hidden and so on. What was it that made you one of those wonderfully weird people
I honestly don't know. I mean, yeah. I couldn't switch it off. To my detriment in many cases, you know, I would feel really upset about, you know, the suffering of an animal that had long since stopped suffering, it was an event long in the past, but I would think about it and it would hurt me, you know. I mean, this is, and I don't like, it's, that's not a good thing, right? That's not an adaptive thing.
It's your own suffering.
I had a terrible time in middle school, partially because I got really mad at the other kids when they were like crushing snails for fun and on a rainy day. And then they started, you know, just teasing me endlessly about that because I cared about the snails. I mean, you know, stuff like that. Like it was never, this was not a helpful thing for me, and it was very, very barely helpful for any actual animals, but this is just how I perceive the world. And, you know, now in retrospect or with a more adult way of thinking, I can build more of a coherent philosophy on top of it. You know, I can think about, you know, I can reason through, like, we shouldn't hurt animals because animals can feel pain, and we don't want to cause pain in creatures that can feel pain. And that's really the only important thing. It's not about cognitive ability. It's about, you know, does that animal suffer? I don't want to cause suffering in the world. I don't want to cause suffering in the world for anything that can experience suffering. Like, you know, I can do that.
It's that simple, yeah.
Yeah, it's not a complicated philosophical argument, but for me, I guess it was that I perceived that suffering existed, and by perceiving the suffering, I suffered, and so I didn't want to be part of causing that suffering. I wanted to do as much as I could to reduce it because I felt it personally.
Yeah.
And that's just kind of been how things have been for me my whole life.
Yeah. So in answering that question of, you know, who's suffering matters, the answer is quite simple. Everybody's suffering matters, yeah. Right? Any being that can suffer should count, right? Why should we exclude it? It seems so simple. And most of the other 8 billion people on the planet haven't yet come to agree with this, but it's only a matter of time. But and as you went through that journey, because you went obviously vegetarian very mm-hmm. young, and I think you're vegan now. What were those transitions like, I guess, socially? Because one of the fascinating things in these conversations is there's often a parallel between, you know, the big life change of moving away from a religious worldview and the life change of moving away from maybe a carnist worldview. Mm. In a sense, the sort of the logic and the evidence and the reason seems pretty clear and controvertible. You know, there's a path you can follow that just makes so much sense. How can others not really see this? But the social context can make those things really difficult journeys.
It was super awkward.
Was it challenging?
I mean, imagine
your mum's face when you.
My family assumed that it was a phase. My grandmother and my sister were very concerned about my health, and they didn't think it was healthy for a kid to be vegetarian. They tried to trick me into eating chicken. So they really were concerned about whether or not I was going to be healthy. I think my parents were just like, well, you know, she's a kid, she goes through these phases, you know, it was, you know, a dramatic interest in horses last week, you know, this'll pass too. Like I think that was the kind of thinking they had. And so they just kind of indulged me, in that phase, and it just didn't go away. And I think eventually it became clear that it was not going to go away. And, you know, they tried to find me meat substitutes. They made sure that I had enough to eat. They would, you know, give me the side dishes at dinner and stuff like that. And so I grew up big and strong. You know, that was never a problem. I was never unhealthy, and I never had any kind of like vitamin deficiencies or anything like that. So it worked out. It was fine. I think once it became clear that I was not going to waste away and that I wasn't going to change my mind about it, it was just like, okay, I guess Katie's a vegetarian. And socially, like among my friends, every once in a while it would just be really awkward, you know, if like we went to a restaurant and there wasn't anything I could eat, or if I had to, you know, remove myself from certain things. But and there were always people who would try to argue with me or make fun of me or whatever. Like that's just a constant. Yeah. I don't know. I just kind of got used to that, I guess. I was never somebody who was very susceptible to peer pressure.
There's a common theme amongst many of my guests. And one of the things I find fascinating and also frustrating is how people think about this subject of veganism and non-human animal ethics more broadly, because it seems that many people will instinctively want to think of it as some sort of weird interest or hobby you have on the side, or a dietary preference, or a purity thing, or, you know, but there's a lot of hesitation about recognizing it as, if you like, another social justice issue, another resistance of oppression, and another, you know, a valid cause, in the same way as intrahuman ethical causes are intuitively treated with seriousness and respect. And you might disagree, but you wouldn't disregard it or joke about it. How have you found that dynamic with others?
I think that a lot of the social awkwardness around it comes from people, from the fact that people do inherently understand it to be a social justice cause, right? Like, so the reason that people don't like vegans, the reason that people are upset when vegans are clear about being vegan, not even about like trying to convert anyone to being vegan, but just like, If I go into a room and it's relevant and I mentioned that I'm a vegan, somebody will be like, oh, you know, vegans are always telling you they're vegan. The reason people are upset about that is because they do see it as a judgment on their own ethical viewpoints, right? Like, I mean, I don't see any other explanation, because it doesn't matter to anybody else what I eat, right? Unless they take it as a personal attack where they think that I'm judging them for not being vegan.
Yeah.
Then it becomes their business, right? And so I think that that it is recognized as that, but only in a sort of surface sense, in the sense that people find it personally threatening. It's the same. So you know, it's kind of funny. There's a parallel I've been seeing lately that it's the same reason why people will sometimes give me trouble about wearing a mask in a public indoor place, because they do understand it to be an ethical decision, right? Yeah. Like, because they feel judged that, like, well, they're not doing that, should, and so they don't want me to be doing it, because I'm reminding them that there is this thing that is happening.
Yeah.
And that I'm you know, trying to not be part of that bad thing, and they're not.
Yeah. So it's having no other impact on them. Nowhere is it influencing their life or harming them at all. It's purely that,
no,
you know, an implied ethical challenge. Yeah.
Exactly. And so like the same reason I'm still wearing a mask indoors, I'm not susceptible to the peer pressure if I'm doing something that I think is important because it's important to me. The same reason I'm vegan, I'm doing something that's important because it's important to me. But I see very strong parallels in terms of how people respond to what I'm doing. And I think it's because people do understand it to be an ethical choice. People do understand it to be a moral, an aspect of morality that they feel that they are inherently being judged for not buying into. So, I mean, yeah, it's interesting. I think that people try to play it off as some kind of weird quirk, some kind of lifestyle choice that has nothing to do with anything. But I think that there is that sort of inherent understanding of what it really means. And I, you know, again, like, I don't try and get into those discussions. I don't talk to people about their personal, you know, food choices.
Yeah.
I don't get into that. I think that like when I was a kid, and people would ask me why I was a vegetarian, I would tell them sentimental reasons. I would either say it's personal reasons or it's sentimental reasons, just because I really didn't want to get into that conversation, because that was a terrible conversation to get into. You could lose friends that way. I didn't want to talk about it. But people would respond to my vegetarianism with hostility because they felt they were being judged.
Yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it? And I think as we come into the final question about the future, that's a recurring theme, is that often the problems we're facing are less about technical challenges or, you know, we really don't know the way forward. Often it is a lot to do with social norms and political will and good old human psychology that's standing in the way. But before we get onto that final question, because that was fascinating, sure. Thanks. And I think you and I share this sense of, I guess, sentience, you know, the capacity to suffer as being the thing that's all you need to be a moral patient, to warrant compassion. Yeah. It doesn't matter how clever you are, what capabilities you've got, your species, you know, what you look like, you know, sexuality, whatever, right? If you have that capacity to suffer, that suffering matters. So in a sense, almost tautologically, that seems to ground any sensible, naturalistic moral stance for me. But before we go on to the final question about the future, I can't resist asking you whether you have a view about what consciousness and sentience actually are. So sentientism itself is completely neutral on philosophy of mind. Personally, I take quite a sort of functional materialistic approach that I think sentience is just a class of information processing we've evolved to run in our heads and other non-human animals as well. But I've spoken to people who have a panpsychist view or even an illusionist view that suggests that phenomenal consciousness, you know, may be an illusion. Do you have a sense from your thinking about what these things actually are, consciousness and sentience?
There's a grand tradition of theoretical physicists getting really into like consciousness.
Yeah.
I don't want to do that. I want to leave the definition of consciousness to the neuroscientists, because I don't think that as a physicist I have any particular insight into that. I don't think that consciousness is like some important element of the cosmos. I think that it's something that happens in the brains of you know, organic creatures. I think that there's a spectrum, right? I think that there you can be semi-conscious, you can be on a spectrum of sentience. When I'm half asleep in the morning, I'm less conscious than I am in the middle of the day. When I'm actually sleeping, when I'm under general anesthesia, I'm in different states of consciousness, different levels of consciousness. And I think that you know, non-human animals can experience varying ranges of those things. I think sentience, I mean, there's nothing very, very specific about the way the human brain works that is vastly different than the way other animals' brains work. We have different sort of mechanisms and processing. I mean, you talked to Adrian Tchaikovsky, so you've presumably thought a lot about spider brains and octopus brains and like all of the different ways that different kinds of animals process information, and those can be fascinatingly different. You know, the way that birds think is very fascinatingly different than the way that mammals think. But it's you know, I think that like there are very few tasks that anybody has come up with that a human can do cognitively that other animals can't do. There was a research report the other day about how there's some evidence that jumping spiders can dream. I mean, it's, you know, the idea that we're so special is just bizarre to me. We're not a separate category. We're a clear, you know, gradual evolution from various kinds of other primates. And there are other animals who've gone through their own evolutions who have can do certain cognitive tasks that we can't do, and there are certain cognitive tasks that other animals can do that we can't do, and there's just a whole range of things. I think that we are fundamentally creatures of matter and circuitry, and like there's no special spiritual spark that we have that other animals don't. And so I think it's very strange to put us in a totally different ethical category or moral category by virtue of, you know, we're the best. I mean, it's just kind of silly to me. And you know, and there's a range of human experience. You know, a little baby has a very different way of processing the world, a very different level of consciousness and sentience than a human adult does. And maybe a little baby experiences the world much more like a dog, you know, or I mean, even, you know, even like a mouse or something. I mean, there's a range of how humans in different stages of development with different, you know, cognitive issues experience the world. There's a range of how other animals experience the world. I don't think it makes sense to place special moral weight on our species, you know, without placing moral weight on the experience of other species. I think as we've talked about a few times, you know, the only thing that really matters is can you suffer, and they all do. So like I don't and I every once in a while I read these ridiculous attempts to explain away, like, oh, you know, fish don't feel pain or something like that. It's none of that makes any sense. You know, we're all in the same category. We all have feelings and we should be weighted accordingly.
Agree. And I think when you look at you know, that common evolutionary history, and you look at common architectures we often share, and you look at inferences from behavior and communications, you know, I can't be 100% sure you're conscious or sentient, but I can certainly build a pretty strong evidence base that you are. You know, I have pretty high confidence. And we can do that across the animal kingdom, certainly, too. Yeah. We just take that naturalistic approach and don't kid ourselves we'll ever get a perfect answer. It seems straightforward to me.
Yeah, and I know that it gets tricky when you have to try and do the numerics about it, like say, you know, is one person worth 10 cows or whatever? Like those questions get complicated. And I don't want to say that a human is less or equal of value than a pig or something. I mean, I think that you have to make judgments, and people do trolley problems with people all the time. Like you have to do those kinds of judgments in whatever way it makes sense. But I know that there are people who just assign zero moral value to non-human animals. And I think that's extremely wrong.
Completely agree. And there are many other people who pretend they assign some moral value, but still think that's consistent with needlessly harming, killing, or exploiting, which I think if you've redefined what moral consideration and compassion mean, if that door is still open to you, right? If you're willing to needlessly harm, kill, and exploit, by definition, that is practically zero compassion to my mind.
I think there's some subtlety to that as well. I mean, I think that, you know, like I assign a great deal of moral value to the suffering of people, and yet I do occasionally purchase things that I know cause the suffering of people, right? Like I I have an iPhone, you know, I've bought clothes from stores that probably have sweatshops, you know, there are a number of ways in which just because we have a moral viewpoint doesn't mean that our actions are always consistent with that. I think that there's a lot of complicated choices that we make, a lot of things that we weigh up. But I do think that, like, once, you know, if you've established the worldview that the suffering of non-human animals matters, that has to have some weight, and we have to grapple with that.
Yeah, and I'd agree. There's no perfection possible here, right? And drawing clear lines often breaks down, and that's partly why I focus very much on this sort of baseline of saying, look, at the very least, we have to have moral consideration for every sentient being. We will still cause harm and maybe even death in some circumstances. It's, you know, it's impossible to live without having some unfortunate consequences, but at least let's grant moral consideration to every sentient being and use that as a starting point. It doesn't answer all the questions. Right. And I also like your approach to this sort of naturalistic understanding of sentience as well. To me, that seems pretty clear, because other people will either take a humble approach to thinking about our consciousness and say, look, we're not special. Consciousness is everywhere. It pervades everything. You know, it's somehow built into quantum physics, or it's, you know, even the electron is conscious. So, and I can sort of, I appreciate that emotionally, because it's at least a humble approach to that, though I don't think it's well-founded. But there is a more arrogant approach as well, which is this sense that our consciousness feels so intuitively special to us, which I understand because it's really all we know, in a sense. Everything comes through our consciousness, that we cannot believe it is just a physical thing. We cannot believe it is just an evolved thing. And whenever the neuroscientists and, you know, people studying it get clearer and clearer about how it functions and what it works and what the anatomy is and how the information is processed, the response is, oh yeah, but you haven't really understood the essence of it, you know, the subjective experience itself. And that, to me, is similar to saying, look, you physicists, you claim you've understood the electron, right? You can describe it in enormous detail with these formulae, but what really is its ineffable essence? Yeah. And I'm like, well, I don't think, to your point, I don't think that's really a useful or meaningful question to ask. And some people will say the answer to both of those questions is consciousness, because the essence of an electron is conscious. And I'm like, okay, fine. So I think you and I have got the right answer. We can let them carry on. I want to respect your time as well. I know you've been so generous. But the final crazily big question is, how can we make a better future in the time we have left? So another big question, and you've thought further into the future than any of my previous guests, because you've worked on many different scenarios for the end of the universe. So you can take this question wherever you like in terms of thinking about, you know, how can we make a better future? And that could be any particular cause. It can be human ethics, intra-human ethics, intra-species ethics, the role of science, science communication. Anyway, you know, how would you make a better world?
Well, I mean, my expertise is in the total destruction of the future, not making it better. So I'm not sure I really have the right background there.
In the meantime, some meaning in the meantime.
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, I think that as human societies evolve, we generally kind of expand our idea of who has moral weight, right? I think that that's happened over many millennia. And I hope that we continue to do that. I hope that we continue to recognize the moral weight of people who are unlike us, and I hope that, you know, I hope that these sort of trends toward isolationism and fascism are temporary. I hope that those things end, because I think that those are definitely a move backward in that way. But you know, that's something that concerns me a lot about the world today. The thing that I worry about, I think, the most in terms of the future of humanity, is I worry that as the worst impacts of climate change become more and more felt, more and more apparent, one way that humanity can respond to that is by becoming more isolationist, more aggressive toward people who are trying to escape, you know, horrible environmental situations, and that can cause us to be you know, worse toward each other, to narrow that definition of who matters. I hope that doesn't happen. I hope that we are able to find a path toward, you know, justice, toward climate justice, toward social justice, toward decolonialism and a path toward being more open and welcoming of people, more helpful to people. I hope that we do follow this path toward climate reparations. That's something that's been somewhat hopeful coming out of the most recent COP meeting. I hope that we're able to do that. I hope that we're able to recognize the congruence of the climate movement and social justice and decolonialism and the recognition of animal welfare as an important part of that. I hope that people start to see that all of those things can come together and be part of the same cause. I think that it's going to be a difficult century, though. I think that this, we're in a time of great change, of great upheaval due to the effects of climate change, and I think that those are going to come in all kinds of different ways, right? I think that those are going to have a lot of different impacts, and I think that there are ways to solve those problems in humane and positive ways. I think that that by adjusting how we think about other people, adjusting how we deal with the non-human world, the natural world in terms of the environment and also animals, I think that there are ways to bring solutions to all these problems together. I don't know if that's the direction we're going to go. So I want to be optimistic about it. I want to hope that we do find those solutions, that we do understand how those solutions can come together in meaningful ways. But I don't know. I'm not sure how it's going
to
go.
It feels finely balanced, doesn't it? Because it feels like it almost comes back to these sort of essential two parts of human psychology. When we're faced with a common challenge, we can come together and collaborate and communicate and work together for a common cause in amazing ways, normally hopefully just in time. Or we can respond to scarcity by doubling down, getting more groupish, getting more aggressive, getting more selfish, and it's difficult to know which way we'll go. And one final question, because I agree, right, when you're thinking about all these different causes, what part of the frustration, I think, is that often it's not about selecting one or the other or trading off. Quite often there are really obvious win-win-win situations staring us in the face. We just need to overcome the political will and the human psychology to break through and just do the right and most obvious thing. What role do you think science and science communication can play in, making that more path more likely?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that it's tricky. I think that the problem of climate change is not that much a science communication problem as a political problem these days. I think that the way that people respond to the ideas of climate change have a lot to do with their worldview, their political affiliations, their values, and
it's like
what
a package
they perceive
of signals
to be,
that go together, isn't it? You have to put up.
And I think people respond because of what they see to be challenges to their ways of life, to their identities, to their fundamental values. And it's not a matter of have we communicated the science properly. I think that the scientific information is out there and I think is largely very well communicated. But when that comes up against questions of people's identities and questions of people's deeply held values, I think that it's very, very challenging for the science to be the thing that they prioritize there, right? So I think that there are ways to communicate about those big questions through better connecting with people on a values level, better connecting with people emotionally, better connecting with how people have concerns about their own futures and their futures of their families. So I think that the kind of communication that really prioritizes that is very important when it comes to these big questions, like things like climate change, like things like social justice, things like stuff that relates to how we can have a better future. Because I think that just giving information is never going to be enough, right? Like that's just not gonna work because it comes up against how people perceive the world and how people feel about themselves and their future and their values and their moral beliefs. But I think there's a big challenge, which is that there are groups, political groups, special interest groups, who have a very strong vested interest in maintaining certain status quo, certain divisions, maintaining ideas of that are contrary to progress in all of these areas, and they have a lot of money. They have a very organized media landscape, and they have the ability to get these messages out and to convince people that their lifestyles, their values are threatened by positive change. So I think it's a really big problem. I think it's really, really difficult. And as a science communicator myself, I run into that a lot. Now, I don't run into that so much in communicating about my own science. Yeah. Not very many people have really strongly held views about dark matter and the Big Bang. Some do. Occasionally you see that, but it's not something that tends to threaten people's personal identities and livelihoods. Yeah. So that makes things safer a lot topics. Easier for me. Yeah,
for now.
To some degree. I mean, there's always people who do get very emotionally caught up in this stuff, but I think that the most important aspects of science that need to be communicated are things that touch on a lot of those big complex issues, and I think that's really hard. So one of the things that I try and do as a science communicator to try to ameliorate that. And one is talking about the process of science, talking about like how we come to the conclusions that we do, so that people can have a better understanding of the fact that we're not just getting together in a room and deciding something for the sake of big green energy or whatever. Yeah. Like there's a process of peer review and careful evaluation that goes into this.
And you love finding out that you're wrong, or
well,
each other are wrong.
No, okay, yeah, we love finding mistakes. We prefer it to be other people's mistakes.
We love
finding a new answer that replaces an old answer. We'd rather not be the one who came up with the old answer replaced by somebody else's new answer. So I think there's a subtlety there.
You're human,
I mean all of science progresses through falsifying previous ideas one way or another, right? So like it is something that is constantly evolving and constantly changing, and we are always trying to push toward those better answers. And the other thing I try and do is like make it clear what scientists are like, what we do. Like I try and be an example of a person who is a visible scientist who is doing science in public, so that people can get a feel for the fact that we really do just want to find the answer. We really do care about understanding these things, and we're not just trying to push an agenda. That's just not how it works. And we are human beings. We're not people who are driven by some amoral push toward gathering data, no matter who we hurt. I know that people have very valid concerns about the possibility for science to cause harm. I mean, a lot of institutional scientific practices have been extremely harmful to people and to the environment over the years, and so like there are legitimate concerns about that. And so one of the things I try and do is try to be an example of somebody who's really not trying to hurt anybody, who's really trying to just find information, just kind of understand the world. And I think the most scientists are doing that, and we're not trying to just publish and we don't care about anybody else perishing. Like most of us are in it for more, more for the sake of curiosity. And so I try and make that clear as well. So there are a couple of things that I think we can do, but I think it's challenging. Some of these big questions about the future do have to do with science to some degree, but I think that the communication problem is oftentimes less of a communication problem and more of a sort of values and societal structure problem in a way that's a lot harder to address.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a difficult balance for scientists as well, because you know you're people with your own values, your own ethics, your own political mm-hmm. stances, and in a sense, you know, it makes sense for you to be open about that and direct and be clear. And I think those values often drive your scientific work. I mean, you know, many scientists are working on their science because of an intellectual curiosity, but also because they want to make the world better. And yeah. we can be unashamed about that. But at the same time, there is a challenge in that, you know, if people feel too much the values or the political engagement, they can start to worry mm-hmm. whether your, you know, scientific work itself maintains integrity. So right. it is difficult to get the balance. But I think, you know, presenting yeah. scientists as some sort of completely emotionally detached, white lab coated,
right.
you know, just churning the RCTs, it's a yeah. it's a naive view and not one that's appropriate or correct.
Right.
And you're certainly one of those people who, you know, you don't just write the end of everything and leave the world with a massive existential crisis. You know, you put an epilogue in there that talks about yeah, meaning yeah. and, you know, what's it all about, and you reassure too.
Yeah.
Your work is absolutely fascinating.
Thank you.
In its scientific work, but also in your public engagement. It's been a real pleasure to get to talk to you. Thank you for being a guest on Sentientist Conversations. What's the best way of people following you, you know, buying your book, of course, staying up to date with your thinking?
So, yeah, my book is widely available. It's called The End of Everything, Astrophysically Speaking. So I had to add that parenthetical so people would know I was really literally talking about everything, not some kind of metaphorical idea.
Yeah, there's no escape.
No, it's really everything. So you can find my book anywhere. I'm on Twitter. Twitter is kind of going through something at the moment, but you can find me there as Astro Katie on Twitter if you want to jump onto that sinking ship. And
I followed you on Mastodon this morning as well.
I'm on Mastodon, mastodon.social as Astro Katie, just in case. Yeah. And I'm on Instagram as Astro Katie Mac. I'm occasionally on TikTok as Astro Katie Mac as well. If you want to look for that, I have a couple of videos up there. I don't do a lot of video stuff, but every once in a while. So you can look for me there too.
Yeah, brilliant. Thank you so much.
My website is astrokatie.com. That has links to everything.
That's great. I'll include the links in the show notes so people can click through. So, well, it's been brilliant to talk to you. Thank you so much. I think I'm going to claim you as a celebrity sentientist, unless you deny it. But naturalism and sentiocentrism, I think you tick both the boxes. So it's been brilliant to talk to you. Thank you so much for all your work too.
Thank you.
Take care. Please stay in touch too. Cheers, Casey.
You too. Thanks.
Thanks for listening. You're helping to normalize rational, compassionate thinking. Don't forget to subscribe, leave us some stars or a review. You can visit sentientism.info to find out more, and you'd be very welcome in any of our online community groups. The biggest is on Facebook. If you like what we're doing, why not tell your friends about us?